Siddhanta Saraswati, who is very dear to Lord Krishna, having taken shelter at his lotus feet. I offer my respectful obeisances to Sri Varshavanavi Devi, Dayata Das, another name of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, who is favored by Srimati Radharani and who is the ocean of transcendental mercy and the deliverer of the science of Krishna. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, the personified energy of Sri Chaitanya's mercy, who deliver devotional service which is enriched with the conjugal love of Radha and Krishna, coming exactly in the line of revelation of Srila Rupa Goswami. Everything all right? Okay. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, who are the personified teachings of Lord Chaitanya. You are the deliverer of the fallen souls. You do not tolerate any statement which is against the teachings of devotional service enunciated by Srila Rupa Goswami. Okay. We're going to have a... I'm going to try to keep this brief because... I know that all of you are eager for the Gita Jayanti, but Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the spiritual master of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, is truly an ocean of mercy. And without him and without his desire, both him and his mother, actually, his mother, of course, was the wife of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and she was very much eager that these teachings of Krishna consciousness were spread to the Western world. Is that me? I hope that's not me. Okay. Please turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. And so it was actually the desire of both Bhaktisiddhanta's mother and father and Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, that this movement be spread. So I'm going to briefly show some slides now, because I think maybe, what do you think, light, if we dim the lights, can you just dim them? That's good, I think. Can you see on that side? Can you? Yeah? And on this side? Okay. Okay, this is Srimati Bhagavati Devi, the mother of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Okay, next. She was Bhaktivinoda's second wife. His first wife died very early, so he remarried. He had one son with his first wife, and then he had about 11 or 12 more with the second. Many offspring, yes. Okay, this is a nice shot of Bhaktivinoda. This is about at the same time of his retirement from his position as a district judge. So, next. This is a kind of family portrait. If you see where Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is there in the upper left, next to him is Lalit Prasad Thakur, his brother, and then some of his other brothers. The mother is there and various relatives. Okay, next. This is age 7, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati at the age of 7. By this time, he had memorized the entire Bhagavad Gita, so which is kind of appropriate for today. He'd memorized the Bhagavad Gita, but he'd done more than memorize it. He'd actually could explain any of the verses at 7. He had what they call eidetic memory, which means, well, sometimes people call it photographic memory. It means anything he'd read, he could remember. So he worked for the king of Tripura. They had libraries. The kings had libraries in those days. And so he would read everything in the libraries. And then later he was mentioning something he'd read, he would say, on page such and such, this is stated. And he would be able to repeat it verbatim. Next, this is, as a young man, he performed many austerities. He took a vow to chant a billion names, and it took him about 11 years. Next. These are some of his early followers. They mention the names at the bottom. Sri Kunja Bihari, Vidyabhushana, who later became Tirtha Maharaj. Then he's in the middle. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is in the middle. And then on the right-hand side, as you face it, is Paramananda Vidyanathan. All of these were very, they were some of his earliest disciples and were very instrumental in spreading the movement in India. Next. This is something which I'm not sure this is what this is, but there was something called Chira Kumar Sabha, which meant they used to be a group of young men that would meet on Beaton Square in Kolkata. And they all took vows of celibacy and discussed the values of celibacy. But I think apparently the only one that followed it absolutely was Bhaktisiddhanta. Next. This is a time when he went to Sanskrit college, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, 1892 to about 1895. Then, next. This was when he was teaching the king, the royal family of Tripura. It was this, a kingdom in the precincts of Bengal, and he was teacher to students, or the sons, excuse me, of the king. And he did this for about 10 years, from 1895 to 1905. Next. This is Bhaktisiddhanta observing Chaturmasya at Rajapatana, in other words, in Mayapur. He was following this Chaturmasya very strictly. He only ate one thing daily, one preparation daily, and he ate from the ground. I don't know how to describe it, like a cow. He bent over and ate it with his hands behind his back. Some kind of khichdi, I think it was. And no bedding. He had no bedding during this period either. So he followed it very strictly at that time. Next is, this is Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj. See if I've got that. Oh, yeah. I'm going to do a plug now for my new book. It's called Babaji Maharaj. You can get it from Amazon if anyone's interested. This is about the lives of Babaji. This is Gaurakishore Das Babaji and Jagannath Das Babaji, who was the spiritual master of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And this is, even though I wrote it, I had to say this is a good book. Amazon. Okay. That's my plug. Then, Gaurakishore, he approached Gaurakishore Bhaktisiddhanta for initiation. His father directed him, Bhaktivinoda Thakur directed him and said, you should take initiation from this person. So when he first met Gaurakishore, Gaurakishore arrived singing this song about separation from Radharani, and he gave Bhaktisiddhanta, that time Saraswati, Siddhanta Saraswati, he gave him some pieces of rope with knots for chanting. He gave him a few things. He gave him a hat, a tiger skin hat that was his guru used to wear, and some other presents. Immediately, as soon as he met him, he gave him these nice presents. And then Siddhanta approached him for initiation, and he was turned down a few times. Because Gaurakishore said, well, you're a great scholar. I don't know anything. Why do you approach me? And he said, besides, I accepted a disciple once. And he went away, so I'm not going to take any more disciples. But finally, Bhaktisiddhanta begged him, and he actually quoted a line from a song by Bhaktivinoda saying, if you don't accept me, I don't know how I'll maintain my life. I can't go on unless you accept me. And finally, Gaurakishore took mercy on him, and he gave him this name, Arshavana Vidayita Das. So this was in 1900, about the year 1900, although there's some dispute about whether it was 1900 or 1901, but at that time he took initiation from Gaurakishore Das Babaji. Next. This is Bhaktisiddhanta. Shortly after the disappearance of both his father, and then a year or two later, the disappearance of Gaurakishore, he wasn't very happy because he didn't know what to do. At least he says like that. I'm just repeating what he said. He said he didn't know what to do, and finally he got some signs that he should spread this movement. And, of course, we know the rest. He did it. Next. This is a picture of Bhaktisiddhanta having taken sannyas. He took sannyas from a picture of Gaurakishore. Unusual. Unusual way of taking sannyas, but that's how he didn't have any other guru at the time. So he took sannyas in that way. Next. This is another picture of, I believe this is an artist rendition of Bhaktisiddhanta based on a photograph. This was taken about 2 days after sannyas. Next. He was about 60 years old when this picture was taken. This time the movement was going full tilt. They always give the figure that he'd established 64 temples. But not only in India, also in Burma and various other places in East Bengal, various places, in England as well, Germany. He had some German disciples who were very, very good scholars, actually. It was just very well suited to the German outlook at the time. Very, very strict, very sincere. Okay, next. This is Bhaktisiddhanta and his disciple, Kunja Bihari, who was the one that encouraged him to go to Calcutta and preach there and helped him establish the first temple in Calcutta. Next. And this is something that sannyasis generally didn't do in India, ride in motor cars. Either you're supposed to go by bullock cart or walk, which had been the way sadhus traveled in those days. But Bhaktisiddhanta was the first, as far as I know, to introduce this going in motor cars and anything that was available to go to places to preach. So this is a shot of him in his car. There's several shots of this, but one with some children who were hanging out next to the car. But this one's the more formal shot of. And he looked quite happy there because he knew it was going to cause a stir that he was riding around in a car. Next, he was on his way to Naimisharanya, by the way, when that car picture was taken. Then this next picture is a gathering of Bhaktisiddhanta and his disciples. This was the inauguration of an exhibition at the Madhva Gaudiya Mutt in Dhaka. Next. This is an interesting picture. Bhaktisiddhanta, you can see in the center, and he's surrounded by all these British and Indian dignitaries, priests and people in various managerial posts and spiritual backgrounds. But it's kind of a great picture from the 30s. Next. Here he is with a group of his disciples. Now it's numbered. If you can see number one, it says Bhaktisiddhanta, right? Then two, that's his, I can't spot it. Yeah, there. Two was Kunja Bihari, always right next to him. And six is the other one we saw earlier, one of his first disciples. Okay, I'm not going to read off all their names. I have a list of all their names here, but it wouldn't mean anything to anybody. So next. This is a colorized picture of Bhaktisiddhanta. This was taken as a black and white initially at the Gaudiya Mutt in Kolkata. Next. 1930s, I can't say exactly when it was taken, sometime in the 30s. A little older in the shot. Next. Bhaktisiddhanta was prepared to wear sort of more European-style clothing, so he had this. It's kind of an interesting combination. He has a turban on, and at the same time, he's wearing a formal overcoat And what do they call those kind of, I can't remember what they call those kind of shoes. Spats of some kind. Very popular in the 30s. 1930s. So he wanted to address as much as possible not only the residents of India, but also the British population. So he dressed in this way sometimes when he met various dignitaries. Okay, next. This is from 1930s again. We're not sure. Next. This is in 1928 in Madras. If you see the sika he's got. there was a whole debate in the movement in the early days whether your sika should be a big, thick thing or it should be a slender one. And so I remember one of the devotees in the temple where I first joined was insistent that it should be like that, a nice thin one with a knot. And then someone else, Vishnu Janmaraj, started another trend, which was to have a real huge, thick one that looked like, I don't know what it looked like, but it was a big, thick, long one. So there was different arguments about what was the best so-called bona fide sika. Okay, next. This is in 1932 at the Madras Gaudiya Math, along with various dignitaries and disciples. Okay, next. This gentleman here, you see God Bless the King. That time it was still India was still controlled a great deal by the British, so he's dressed a bit formally, and he's with the governor of Bengal at that time named John Anderson. This was in 1935. And he gave him quite a tour of the all the developments of Mayapur that he was making. And next, we have here again with the governor of Bengal, John Anderson. This, again, it was 1935. A lot of pictures were taken at that time because it was considered a big event that the governor of Bengal had come to see the developments in Mayapur. Okay, next. This is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Okay. These are all his sannyas disciples. I don't know if it's all of them, but there's quite a few of them there. And you can't tell. The details of the picture are not great, but this is the only pictures. These are the pictures I could find. Next. This is him arriving at the Madras Central Rail Station in 1932, January. Then this next shot is again the Madras Gaudiya Math. Next, with all these personalities. And next, this is a Vyas Puja ceremony that was held in 1935 in Jagannath Puri. He gave quite an amazing talk at that time, which you can find if you're interested. Okay, next. This is a little esoteric in the sense that this is also at the Madhva Gaudiya Math, but these persons he's with, one of them was called E.B.J. Baker. It was a district judge of Dhaka, and J.R. Blair, the magistrate of Dhaka. So these are considered important persons at that time, so he was hosting them. Next. Here he is with the Maharaj of Tripura. He had been a teacher of the students of the original king at Tripura, and this one of these students later became the king. So this is the Maharaj of Tripura. And this was a picture was taken at the inauguration of the new temple at the Yoga Pit in Mayapur in 1935. Next, here Bhaktisiddhanta is checking an article for the Gaudiya magazine. He had a Gaudiya magazine, which was very, very popular. There was also a newspaper that he published during his lifetime, which was a daily newspaper. And so somebody's asking, how can there be a daily newspaper for on spiritual topics? He says, no. He says, there could be a paper at every second. So, in other words, he didn't find any difficulty in coming up with more and more to speak about in this newspaper. He wrote many, many articles. Another shot. This is Bhaktisiddhanta, not too long before he passed away. Looking quite more elderly, but always very grave and serious. Next. This was one of the last. This is a colorized version of a black and white shot that was taken in his last years. And next. This is the last photo that was ever made of Bhaktisiddhanta. And he passed away in 1936/37. So that's the end of that. Now I need to show you what to put up next. So we've had lots of pictures now, and now we're going to have some philosophy. Okay. Can you go back to the... Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. This will just take a second. So now what we're going to do is read some famous quotations by Bhaktisiddhanta and maybe briefly discuss a few of them. I know there's not a lot of time. We have about a half an hour. We'll see what we can do. Yes. So this is prior to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's initiation. We have anybody with a nice... Do we have an additional microphone for people in the audience? Is it hard to... Okay, can you turn it on and give it to Haridas Varya? And we'll start with Haridas Varya. Okay, so you read this very clearly. Is it working? Okay, go ahead.
Because I was...
That's not loud enough.
Because I was always intoxicated with the worldly false ego and the desire for name and fame, I deprived myself of my own real benefit. But because of the influence of my previous birth's activities in devotional service, I came into the association of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is my spiritual well-wisher. My spiritual master, Srila Gaur Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj, would go and visit Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and many times would reside with him. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, out of his compassion for other living entities, pointed out my spiritual master, Srila Gaur Kishore Das Babaji. Upon seeing my spiritual master, the extent of my worldly false ego diminished. I knew that all the other living entities who have taken the human form of life but also fallen and low like myself. But by gradually observing the spiritual character of my master, I realized that only a Vaishnava could reside in this material world and be of exemplary character.
So this, someone who wonder, why would Bhaktisiddhanta speak like this? He was, by this time that he took initiation, he was a famous scholar, very learned, had defeated all kinds of people in argumentation. But when he saw his spiritual master, this was his mentality. This is the way he felt. So I just wanted to give some idea of his humility in approaching his spiritual master. Go to the next slide. So now, who else would like to read? Otherwise, I'll just have Haridas read everything. But you have to read loudly. Okay, go ahead.
Humbly and sincerely, I pray to the Supreme Lord for his mercy. Later, by his grace, I recognize that without receiving the blessings of this peerless saint and without serving him, nothing good could happen to me. When I accepted that and acted accordingly and then received the causeless, unlimited grace of my Sri Gurudeva and refuge at his lotus feet, I deemed my life fulfilled.
Thank you. Okay. So this is just a couple of statements that he made, his sincere feeling. Sometimes people think, oh, well, Gaur Kishore was practically illiterate, so why was he so in awe of Gaur Kishore? It's because Gaur Kishore was an amazing devotee. He was basically illiterate, but if you ask him any kind of difficult philosophical question, he'd immediately answer it in a way that nobody could do anything but be amazed. So, next. This will be the last of his statements of humility, but there's a whole list of them I gave in a class here once before, amazing things he had to say about Gaur Kishore. But here, this is the nice one also. So now read that one also.
I was a fearsome debater, but with great kindness, my Gurudev kicked out my pride in debating. Even in unlimited millions of lifetimes, I will not be able to find the limit of his compassion, nor will anyone else be able to do so. Although I am unfit, he recognized me as his servant, thus fulfilling my cherished desire by which I may live forever.
So you see how he felt. He felt that he was unfit, and that by being recognized as a servant of his guru, he felt his whole life was perfect, just by that mercy. Okay, next. But this is some illustrative stories that he tells. This is one of them. Who would like to read next? Okay. Just make sure you read loudly and clearly.
Search for truth, the Sadhu.
Not loud enough.
Search for truth, the Sadhu. It is for this reason that the Bhagavad instructs us to turn over a new leaf. Persons of good sense must entirely give up all association with bad company and cultivate close association with the Sadhus. There is no doubt that the words of the Sadhu possess the power of destroying the evil propensities of one's mind. The Sadhus in this way benefit everyone who associates with them. There are many things which we do not disclose to the Sadhu. The real Sadhu makes us speak out what we keep concealed in our hearts. He then applies the knife. The very word Sadhu has no other meaning than this. He stands in front of the block with the uplifted sacrificial knife in his hand. The sensuous desires of men are like the goats. The Sadhu stands there to kill those desires by the merciful stroke of the keen edge of the sacrificial knife in the form of unpleasant language. If the Sadhu turns into my flatterer, then he does me harm. He becomes my enemy. If he gives us flattery, then we are led to the road that brings enjoyment, but no real well-being.
So this is a colorful description by Bhaktisiddhanta. The function of the Sadhu is not to tell you how wonderful you are. Essentially, a lot of what the Sadhu has to say to you is, you're an idiot. Now do this, do that, and stop being so puffed up and stop. You know, the Sadhu is not supposed to flatter you. He's supposed to tell you the truth and help you advance in Krishna consciousness. So, I mean, it doesn't mean the Sadhu will never speak anything pleasant, but it does mean that he'll speak whatever you need to hear. Okay, we'll go next. Now, this is another interesting story. I find some of these stories, he's making a philosophical point here, but at the same time it's very entertaining. Guru Shakti, is it Guru Shakti? Why don't you read this? Give her the microphone, please. Nice and loud, though. You got the, no shyness, okay?
A certain boatman was troubled.
No, louder.
A certain boatman was troubled by the idea that the operation of pulling at the cord for towing his boat was a miserable job involving great hardships, inasmuch as it required him to trudge painfully along most uneven ground over thorn and brambles, which often stuck into the bare soles of his feet. Therefore, if he could manage to get rich somehow, he would be in a position to tug at his cord by bestriding quilts and mattresses, which he would take care to spread over either bank of the river.
Okay, let me just stop you just for a second. So in other words, this boatman had the job of pulling boats upstream. And you could only do that by pulling on a rope. Right? So he was thinking, if I could just get rich, I would line the banks of the river with mattresses. Okay, go ahead.
The boatman of the story was so foolish that he intended to carry all the miserable pursuits of his poverty-stricken state into the condition of affluence. The consideration that if he could get rich, it might not be necessary for him to tug at the cord at all, would not penetrate his foolish pate.
Now, foolish pate, that's an old expression which means head. Head. Didn't trouble his head. Go ahead.
Those persons who are bent on journeying to the transcendental realm, laden with all the superstitions and material judgments of this world, who are anxious to transport their sense-ridden logic to the transcendental realm, who choose to imagine that in the realm that lies beyond this world can be any scope for the unavoidable slave mentality of this world or any other form of service which is any way characterized by the factors of the unwholesomeness of this world, are indeed as stupid as the foolish boatman of the story. The function of the servant that prevails in the realm of the absolute, the servitude of the soul, in the state of freedom from the fetters of material bondage, is a natural condition of the soul, i.e. perfect subordination in his own proper nature, swadhinata. By such servitude, even unconquerable Godhead himself is subdued. The Supreme Lord of all lords becomes our own.
So Bhaktisiddhanta is making a grave point, but in a kind of humorous way, he's basically saying we're like that boatman, that we try to drag our material conceptions to the spiritual platform. Just like the boatman's thinking, oh, I'll solve my problems by putting mattresses down, and not realizing if you have that kind of wealth, you don't need to tug the boats anymore. So we're like, in a way, we're like that, that we are thinking so many things about what it'll be like in the spiritual world, but actually you won't have any of the problems you have in this world and that world. There will be no birth, death, old age, and disease, etc. It's adiatmic, adibautic, adidaivic, etc. So, thank you. Next. Okay, this is, you want to give it to somebody else? Who else would like to read? Any of the other ladies would like to read? But just, if you do read, just read loudly.
From the pathway to highest good. Blessedness, the Guru, God has said, SB 11.26.26, a truly intelligent person should shun evil company but seek association with holy saints who with their instructions know not of the worldly attachments of our mind. The meaning is that our true well-being, we should always accept the guidance of the true Guru, spiritual guide, and should not be misled by pseudo-gurus. The Guru never accepts the Priya Pantha, way to pleasure, but he is a Shreya Panthi, that is, he follows the way to the true well-being. He gives others, that is his disciples, the same instruction to follow the way to the true well-being. He gives others, that is his disciples, the same instruction to walk along the real path as he has received it from his own guru, of course a true one. If a disciple asks permission of the guru for drinking, he is sure to disapprove of it and never to grant it. When the guru does not indulge the disciple in his prayer for things after his mind, he may dismiss the guru. Such disciples accept only the gurus that are ready to supply fuel for their sensualism. Acceptance of a guru has become a fashion nowadays, not for the disciple's true well-being, but for getting one's sensual pleasures approved of. Such appointments satisfy only the social or family customs like those of barbers and washers.
These are some kind of strong words by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He's basically saying that people have a tendency to accept a guru as a fashion. Oh, I have my guru. Certain gurus are very popular, and therefore you think, well, I won't have the right prestige, if I don't accept such and such a guru. But that's not the reason to accept a guru. And Bhaktisiddhanta is saying that if the guru is not going to approve your nonsense, if he's a bona fide guru, he's not going to say, oh, you just want to, you just drink a little bit, that's okay. No, he's going to tell you not to do it. And some people are not are a little insincere, and they just give up spiritual life altogether because the guru is not satisfying their desires for, as Bhaktisiddhanta says, sensualism or sense gratification, the way we say it. So he's just giving, and he compares that kind of acceptance of guru, just somebody that fulfills your desires. He calls it, it's like like accepting a barber or a washer. Interesting. Not any more elevated than that. Okay, next. This is an interesting answer. This is a gentleman, William Henry John van der Stok of Batavia, it says here. I don't know where Batavia is. Maybe it was part of Germany. On December 26, 1935. And he asked this question. Okay, now, on this side, you'd like to read? Can you pass the microphone over now? Can you help us? Let's do this quickly. Come on. Okay, now remember, nice and loud. I think it's on. Okay, go.
Question, do you know the absolute gradually or at once? Answer, the knowledge of the absolute can be had all at once. There is no factor of time or space. If we are at all intent on knowing him, we must have some sort of objective reference for his subjective activity. Now we are busy with worldly affairs. We think we are men and women. Instead of doing so, we should be serving him. And when he participates with our pure selves, we will be set free from all the tempting influence of the different things of nature. We want that we should go back.
Yeah, now read this part very wonderfully. Go ahead.
Very wonderfully.
Wonderfully.
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, you can do it.
Okay. Like a shooting star, we have strayed out of the range of his attraction. Like a comet, we are journeying without cessation. Our eternal condition is that we are absolute infinitesimals, and as such, we should dovetail with the absolute infinity. The function between him and us is love. He is the lover. If he loves us, we will be taken back. If he has an apathetic tendency towards us, it is because we are averse to him, and we will be...
Please don't do this. Gonna go behind, please. Go ahead.
I've just got to find my place again. Okay, if he has an apathetic tendency towards us, it is because we are averse to him, and we will be undergoing 84 lakhs of births and deaths again and again. It would be judicious for us that we should go back to the absolute infinity, and all our engagement should be with him and not with anybody else.
This is... A short answer about knowing God, becoming God realized. But I love this part where he says, like a shooting star, we have strayed out of the range of his attraction. Like a comet, we are journeying without cessation. I mean, it's poetic, but it's very descriptive of the jivas traveling throughout the three worlds in a bewildered state, looking for the absolute truth. And not realizing what he's looking for, unless he's fortunate enough to meet a great soul. Okay, we have some more. Go on, one more. Now this one's kind of not humorous, but again descriptive. Maybe Prayojana, are you up for reading? You're going to pass that over to Vyojana? It's in the back. It's as big as I could make it, unfortunately. Oh, okay. Is that going to be too hard to read for you? Because I'll get somebody up closer to do it. Can you see it? Not easily. Okay, you've got it. All right, so... You want to read? Nice and loud.
What relish can there be in this decaying body, made up of the five decomposable elements and full of putrescence and impurity? Shall we not mind for a moment that this perishable and ever-changing body is liable to wrath, ambition, illusion, fear, grief, envy, hatred, separation from those we hold most dear, and association with those we hate? What relish can there be for material enjoyments when we are exposed to hunger, thirst, disease, depressitude,
decrepitude,
emaciation, growth, decline, and death? The universe is tending to decay. Grass, trees, animals spring up and die. Mighty men are gone, leaving their joys and glories. Being still greater than these have passed away. Vast oceans have dried, mountains have been thrown down, the polar star displaced, the cords that bind the planets rent
asunder.
The whole earth
deluged
with flood. In such a world, what relish can there be for fleeting enjoyments? Living in such a world, we are not like frogs jumping in a dried up well.
So this is Bhaktisiddhanta's description of being in this world, kind of in a very almost humorous manner, describing such a temporary place. Everything's being created and destroyed at an alarming rate. And then the last part I want you to read, because I think you've got the right vocal style for this. Okay, now read this next section.
To get rid of the deception of this false and treacherous seeming friend, we should be sincerely suppliant before the Supreme Lord and water our couch with tears. He will receive our prayers, have mercy on us, and out of his naturally loving kindness appear before us as the preceptor, with all the proficiency in the scriptures and fully free from the hankerings of the senses, to rid us from the clutch of the wicked mind, which has flame all around and death within, to cut asunder all its knots and hitches, and to dispel all our darkness of the heart, as an elephant runs away from the darkest recesses of the jungle at the approach of the lion, and the veil of darkness is withdrawn from the surface of the earth at the advent of aurora. Then the mind will brood over its guilty woes like a scorpion girt by fire.
Okay, I should explain this a little bit. Basically, he's giving an analogy, first of all, what our attitude should be, that practically by tears, by sincere entreaty, we should try to get the Lord's mercy. Then he compares the mind, the troublesome mind, to a scorpion is surrounded by fire. And what the scorpion does when it's surrounded by fire is it stings itself and passes away. So he's talking about the extinguishing the influence of the mind. But it's very poetic language. This is not easy to follow in many respects. Okay, we'll go to the next one. We're almost at the end, actually. This is a great one. Now, anybody, any good in drama? It's near the front. Any good dramatists? He is? Okay, then you should read this one. But, you know, emote. Express it. Go ahead. This is a good one, too.
From real and apparent, the voice of the soul.
I just want to say, this is the soul speaking to the mind and body. This is what the soul has to say to the mind and body. Okay, go.
The awakened soul says, in effect, to the mind and body, I am not identical with you. I do not want what you require. I have so long believed that I was identical with yourselves and that our interests were the same. But I now find that I am really and categorically different from you. I am made wholly of the principle of self-consciousness, while both of you are made of dead matter. Being matter, you can act and be acted upon by matter under the laws of nature. Nature makes and unmakes you, but she has no power over me. I am not benefited by your growth or harmed by your decay. You grow and decay by the laws that govern your relationships with this physical universe. falsely identifying myself with you, I find myself compelled to suffer pain and pleasure due to physical vicissitudes that overtake you. I find myself unnaturally yoked to your functions such as eating, drinking, producing thought, etc., etc., and am forced to believe them to be my own functions by which I am benefited. I shall, of course, have to stay with you as long as it is intended by Providence that I should suffer the consequences of this unnatural alliance with you. I shall permit you to do only what I consider to be necessary for my well-being, viz., getting back into my natural position of free conscious existence, unhampered by the unnatural domination by longing for material enjoyment. I refuse to be any more a slave of the sensuous inclinations of the mind and body.
We should cheer the soul's determination. The soul key? Yeah. The sincere soul is speaking like this to the mind and body. Okay, next. I'm not sure how many more I've got. Does it show how many? Just two more? Okay, we think we can squeeze them both in. Okay. Actually, we'll skip this one. Go to the next one. Go ahead and skip it. Okay. This is the final one. Well, somehow we managed to do it in the right amount of time. I'm stunned. I'm sorry I couldn't interact with you more, but I'm constrained by time. Otherwise, I would have gone on and on until you were exhausted. So this, Prabhupada used to recite this from the Brahma Sanghita, written by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And it's a beautiful, poetic and beautiful philosophical statement. So you go ahead and finish now. Go on. Yeah, come on.
From Brahma Sanghita. The materialistic demeanor cannot possibly stretch to the transcendental autocrat.
Okay, I just want to kind of explain it a little. It means people like us who are materially conditioned cannot stretch to see the transcendental autocrat, Krishna. Okay, go ahead.
Who is ever inviting the fallen conditioned souls to associate with him through devotion or eternal serving mood. The phenomenal attractions are often found to tempt sentient beings to enjoy the variegated position which is opposed to undifferentiated monism. People are so much apt to indulge in transitory speculations, even when they are to educate themselves on a situation beyond their empiric area or experiencing jurisdiction. The esoteric aspect often knocks them to trace out immanence in their outward inspection of transitory and transformable things. This impulse moves them to fix the position of the immanent to an indeterminate impersonal entity, no clue of which could be discerned by moving earth and heaven through their organic senses.
I'll try to give a little bit of an explanation, although it's a little bit pretentious to think that I can. But so this is basically describing the limitations of our intelligence and our mind and the body, the limitation that we think that we can understand the absolute truth by a mental speculative process. So he's saying that the Lord is inviting everyone to come back to him in the transcendental world. But people have a tendency to try to use their mind and senses to speculate. And he says transitory speculations because they're constantly changing. And, you know, we're guessing. You're trying to understand something which is beyond the reach of your senses. So he's saying that this impulse often tends to call the people think that the absolute truth is ultimately impersonal. If there is a God, he must just be like something completely different from matter. He couldn't be a person, in other words. He couldn't be a person. So with the process of the speculative process or empiric process, no one can understand. And he says, even if this is a great, the last line is a great one. He's saying, even if you moved heaven and earth through your organic senses, in other words, if you try to use sense perception to understand the absolute truth, it doesn't matter if you move heaven and earth through your senses, take everything in the universe, you still wouldn't be able to understand. So this is his... Bhaktisiddhanta was a great writer. To some degree, he wrote in a very esoteric manner, partly because of the intellectuals of Kolkata, who were quite prominent and considered themselves great thinkers. So he often, when he wrote in English, he would write in a very, very, you could say flowery, but you could also say very poetic, very wordy. They say that he had such a tremendous vocabulary that he studied Milton and Shakespeare to improve his English. And if he came trying to think of a word in Sanskrit in English, trying to translate a Sanskrit word into English, if he couldn't come up with one, he would use Latin roots and just make up a word. So then when these intellectuals would read it, they would say, I can't even understand what he's saying. And then they would say, he must be great. He's so brilliant that I can't even follow everything he's saying. So this was Bhaktisiddhanta, a very powerful lion guru. They used to call him a lion because he had no patience with impersonalism or people that were just speculating about the absolute. And he would speak in such a way that they would become bewildered and admit that they didn't understand half of what he was saying, although he was telling them the absolute truth. But in words that sometimes was... It's like with sound... You know, sometimes, like dogs and other animals, they can hear sounds that are very, very high that we can't even hear. So Bhaktisiddhanta's writing and words sometimes are like that. They're not comprehensible by the ordinary person. To some degree, yes, he could speak very plainly when he wanted to, but this was for the so-called intelligentsia of his time, this type of presentation. So anyway, that's all the time we have for. If there's a few questions or one or two questions, I could try to answer them. Well, 1, 2, 3. Anybody over here? I don't know how much time they're going to give me before I have to get out of here, but 5 minutes? Okay. I've never heard that. I've never read it. It's not impossible in my mind, but I don't think so. He did create a Vaishnav dictionary, though, at one point. He did about 4 volumes, but then ran out of time.
Thank you so much for your very, very nice elaboration and elucidation on Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. In some of the texts that you shared, he kind of harshly hits the hypocrisy that we have within our minds, that we can marry our materialistic desires under the garb of spiritual practice and, by the mercy of the saintly persons, be liberated from it all.
Yes.
And I see myself as a victim of this, where I try to mentally rationalize it and under the garb of, let's say, Yukta Vairagya, that, oh, I'll do what I want and get that materialistic exchange, but also I'll connect it somewhat to Krishna. Mm. Just based on your understanding of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, how can we marry this impetus that we have?
Are you talking about marrying the speculative tendency with the absolute truth?
Yeah, or also on our own individual attempts, like to.
Well, we have a process we call dovetailing, which means that you take your material habits or propensities and try to find a way to Krishnize them. So that requires some intelligence and some thoughtfulness. For instance, suppose you admire someone out in the world who's a very powerful speaker. And so rather than focus on what they're saying, you focus on learning to be a powerful speaker for Krishna. So in other words, you use your own tendencies or your own interests to try to connect them in some way to Krishna. So I think Bhaktisiddhanta definitely advocated that. So it's legitimate as long as you don't go overboard. You know, because there's also a tendency to think you can rationalize anything then. No. You have to truly connect it with Krishna. Find a way to connect it. I know Rita Nandamaraj calls it the dovetail washing machine. Try to purify your thoughts by connecting them in some way to Krishna. Anybody else? I can't see you very well. Anybody over there have a question? Okay, hand here. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Prabhuji, for such a wonderful presentation. One of the things you mentioned I didn't know was that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had a godbrother. Do we have any further information about him?
To my knowledge, he had no godbrother.
I thought you said Gokishor Das Babaji Maharaj said that he had one disciple and he went.
No, Gokishor said that he once had one who went away, who left, okay, and didn't follow him. So then he was reluctant to accept anybody else. But according to Bhaktisiddhanta, he was the only disciple, okay, who was actually following. I think he encouraged, Gorkhasura encouraged many people to chant the holy name. Many people. Again, if you want to know more about it, read my book, Babaji Maharaj, where I discuss all of his interactions with different people approaching him. But Gorkhasura would encourage everybody to chant, and some of them who he encouraged to chant considered themselves his disciples, but they were not formally his disciples. Any other thing? Oh, yes, Hari Das for you.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Thank you for the wonderful class. I was wondering if you could recall
the readings. Can you speak a little louder?
When Bhaktisiddhanta dealt very strongly with Imayavadi, you know, an example of that?
Say it
again. When Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati dealt very strongly with Imayavadi, any example of that?
Well, I know that this story may or may not be so, but this is told in the Gaudiya Mat anyway, that he saw some famous Mayavadi walking down the street, and he collared him, actually physically grabbed the front of his shirt and said, "Why do you cheat?" You know, he kind of got very threatening with him because he didn't approve of what he was teaching people. So, you know, he was always arguing against Mayavad. You know, this was his mission. This is Srila Prabhupada's mission also. Nirvisesha Sunyavadi. So the Buddhists and the Mayavadis and the impersonalists, he didn't approve of their philosophies. Okay, time's up. Thank you all very kindly for your attention. Hare Krishna.